That's me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, agenda review. Anybody like to change the agendas? Kind of hard to do since there's only one item tonight.
And no one here.
Excuse me. Okay. Community comments and suggestions. Anybody in the audience that would like to address the commission on anything that's not on tonight's agenda, now would be your chance. Seeing none, we'll move forward to written communications. I don't see any.
None this evening.
Thank you. Consent agenda, approval of minutes for February 16th. Is there any additions or corrections?
They look comprehensive. I move for approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Public hearings. This is a continuation of a draft of the housing element update. You have a staff report, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keene and members of the commission. The purpose of tonight's hearing is to review and receive public comment on both the draft housing element update and draft ordinance regarding emergency shelters. The commission considered this item in January and continued the hearing so that staff could provide additional public outreach. Notice of this hearing and information about the housing element was sent to roughly 50 organizations and individuals that either expressed interest in the past regarding the document or might have some interest given the nature of their organization. Because the commission has already reviewed the document, I will briefly go over the main points and the proposed changes since the last housing element update, which was in 2013. So the main purpose of the housing element is to increase the supply of housing that is equitable for families of all income categories with an emphasis on infill development. The reason why we are also considering the emergency shelter ordinance at this time is because the State Department of Housing and Community Development requires, which is HCD, requires all communities to accommodate emergency shelters through a zoning amendment prior to certifying any housing element. So this slide shows Arroyo Grande's fair share of the anticipated future housing demand. These numbers are based on a formula that considers population, income, employment, and vacancy factors. Each city is required to update their housing element to accommodate future housing demand. However, these units don't have to be built. We just have to show that the city can accommodate through zoning and general plan land use element. During the last cycle, we were required to accommodate a total of 362 units. The distribution of 242 in this particular cycle represents a 33% decrease, which makes our task that much easier. Most of the goals, policies, and programs from the previous update are still appropriate and have been retained. However, several policies and programs have either been added or revised for clarity purposes since the previous housing element update. And these include establishing a program to provide assistance to first-time home buyers, monitoring the loss of permanent workforce housing from vacation rentals, amending the zoning ordinance to encourage farm worker housing, and amending the development code to define transitional and supportive housing as allowable residential uses. Program G1-3 was amended in response to City Council comments from the previous housing element update to include more control over design of large multifamily projects. This program was modified to allow up to 15 multifamily attached units with a minor use permit, subject to architectural review. Proposed developments then that are over 15 units would require a conditional use permit, and HCD was fine with this. After resubmitting the draft housing element to HCD last year, that agency responded with additional city actions that must occur prior to document certification, and these include implementing Program K2-1 regarding emergency shelters, implementing Program K2-2 regarding transitional and supportive housing, then also including a program that increases the allowable density in the office mixed-use zoning district from 15 to 20 dwelling units per acre for standalone multifamily housing developments with just a minor use permit, and then also to ensure that there is adequate opportunity for public participation throughout the update process. The housing element has been amended to include all of this information, and the proposed draft ordinance implements programs K2-1 and K2-2. As I mentioned, we greatly expanded the mailing list for modification. In total, there will be 3 public hearings, so this is the 2nd public hearing, and the 3rd public hearing will be at City Council on March 22nd. Regarding the proposed ordinance for emergency shelters and transitional and supportive housing, staff proposes to add definitions, amend the use tables, and then include development standards. The definition of emergency shelters is on the screen, as you can see, which is taken directly from state government code. These facilities provide housing for a limited amount of time for homeless persons with minimal support services. Supportive housing, I know it looks long up there, I won't say it all. It does not have a limit on the length of stay, and it's linked to services to assist the residents in retaining housing, improving health status, and maximizing the ability to live and hopefully work in the community. It's considered a residential use and is therefore only subject to restrictions that apply to other residential uses in that same zoning district. Transitional housing, again, I will not read all that, is rental housing operated under a program that requires recirculation of the assisted unit to another person after 6 months. Like supportive housing, it's considered a residential use and only subject to the requirements of any other residential use in that particular zone. As previously discussed, it is proposed that emergency shelters be allowed in the industrial mixed use and the highway mixed use zoning districts with just a minor use permit. And it is also proposed that transitional and supportive housing be permitted in all residential districts consistent with state law. State law also allows cities to impose development standards in the local regulations for emergency shelters. Staff proposes that standards regulating the maximum number of beds, lighting, on-site management, on-site waiting and intake areas, laundry facilities, refuse facilities, common facilities, outdoor activities, and facility location be included. So in summary, the intent of the housing element is to provide the necessary conditions for producing and preserving an adequate supply of affordable housing, including special needs housing. It includes strategies that address the city's local housing needs, including a land inventory adequately zoned for housing in all income categories, and a commitment to assist in housing development through regulatory concessions and incentives. So staff is therefore recommending to the Planning Commission to first review and receive public comment on the draft housing element update and adopt a resolution recommending that the City Council approve the document. And then second, adopt a resolution recommending that Council adopt an ordinance regarding emergency shelters. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Commissioner Mack, any questions of Council's staff?
I have a few generic questions. That the housing element Exhibit A that was distributed to us, it refers to it as a draft. Has that been approved, or are we approving that as this action tonight as well?
The City Council actually approves the housing element, so you're just making a recommendation whether or not the document appears to be adequate, or unless if you have any suggestions for improvements, then that would be transferred to the Council at the March 22nd meeting.
So my second question is the initial study, the negative deck that's been provided, is that a negative deck for the entire housing element document?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So with that, I have a couple comments knowing that as opposed to just the items that we're approving tonight regarding the changes. So I don't know whether to start with that in terms of a discussion. I'll probably just continue on with my questions here. I reviewed this whole housing element in its entirety, and I had a couple questions on that. Can I ask questions about that as well?
Certainly.
Okay. Concerning policy B1, I guess after 45 years or 50 years or how many years it is of an owner-occupied unit that can transfer over to market-rate housing. So my question is, and then also says if it sells in the interim, that renews into another 45-year cycle. So my question is when we lose our stock or lose our owner-occupied affordable housing stock, is there a trigger to City Council or the city of how many units we're losing a year so we can replenish that stock?
Well, we have actually lost a number of moderate income units, and it's something that's a little bit out of our control as to how for the previous units that were approved. The formula is based such that the moderate rate for the last number of years, the sales price, in other words, has been higher than the market rate because of the way the formula is made up. So we've already lost a number of units, and it is staff's opinion over multiple year discussions that we're not restricting units in market rate housing projects. We are instead getting the in-lieu fees so that we can then support nonprofit organizations that provide affordable housing, such as, you know, People Self-Help Housing, Haslo, industries like that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what we can do to replenish that when it's gone, or what mechanism there is, or whether we even entertain a mechanism in the housing element to identify that. And when we do lose those homes, how do we recapture that? Because eventually, when the city lives on forever, we're going to lose all our stock. We won't have any.
Yeah. What it's turning out to be is more like a first-time home buyers program, you know, where the people that got in, they were able, and it was during, you know, when the economy, well, actually before the economy took a plunge, and the housing prices were just really crazy. So it really did benefit a number of property owners. And we feel good about that. But it does end up being, like I said, a first-time home buyers program, you know, because we did lose quite a number of them. However, I should say that we still maintain a number of housing units as well. And it's been probably about a year since I've processed any paperwork to, you know, release a unit.
So those are actually home-occupied homes, and they fulfilled the full 45 years or 50 years. And it wasn't sold at the 15th year and translated, you know, it didn't revert back to market rate is what they went the full duration.
And that is only because of the formula, again. The formula, it became a situation where, what are we going to do? The formula is, you know, something that's been a recorded document, And when you plug in the numbers, the moderate rate has been higher than the market rate, and it doesn't make any sense. So it's been a real problem.
Yeah, and I'll just make a quick clarification. So the policy directs the city to require deed restricted affordable units and under this policy, in which we have been doing. Now, typically, those would be approved and restricted for that number of years, and then you'd lose some, and you'd keep approving projects and requiring some, so it all balances out. We did lose some before the duration of the normal deed restriction because of the formula Kelly's referring to, in that upon resale of those units where the deed restriction was supposed to remain in place, there's a provision that if they can't sell the unit at the deed restricted price, then after a series of steps, the unit reverts back to a market rate unit. And because of the formula and because of the market at the time, we did lose some units through that provision. But we also had been approving affordable units, by using our housing fund to partner with, for example, People's Self-Help. So we've achieved a growing number of units through that mechanism. So we've actually kind of come out ahead, but I just wanted to provide that clarification.
So it's really not a written rule. We've just been...
There's no rule that says if we lose one, we must get one.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And that was my point. I didn't know whether we wanted to try and identify that in the housing element or not.
Yeah, I guess the rule is sort of there if you say whatever units you provide, you must provide that in lieu fee. So you continue supplying housing over time, or you secure a unit. So it's there. It's just not on a one-for-one ratio.
So the next topic I'm going to roll on to was... the policy C4, it talks about, waiving the possibly the fees for going through the development process in terms of getting your ministerial approvals. But my question is, don't we want to try and really create incentives for the developers, because they're not offering us low to very low products? They're just not doing it because it's not affordable for them to do. Do we want to also include fee reduction incentives as well, the permit fees, or whether it's a park and lieu fee? Or you kind of hint to it in G1.2. I'm wondering if we should reiterate it under C4 as well.
Well, there are policies in here, and we actually already do have lower impact fees for very low and low income. Housing. Is that what you're referring to?
Correct.
Yeah, we already do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, this is going to be a big one for me. D.1, and I'd seriously like to have a discussion with everyone about this. Why are we allowing a relaxed parking standard on D.1 when these are the very projects that impact overflow parking into the public streets? And then I have a second part to that.
Yeah, I know parking is a big issue with the commission, and the idea is that these people are going to be using more public transit than others. So it wouldn't be, a family of four, there may be one vehicle versus a family of four that has a house in Rancho Grande would have seven vehicles. You know what I mean? So that's the idea behind it. And HCD has been pushing for, providing parking seems to be the determinator of whether or not a project can even be feasible or not because of various jurisdictions and what they require for their parking. It makes it very difficult for to do low-income housing projects and get the density. So there's obstacles there, and that's what they've been talking with us about, is just trying to remove the governmental constraints. And one of them is the density requirement that we talked about, right, that I talked about in my presentation about the OMU and allowing for higher density for pure multifamily projects. And the other is for the parking and other concessions. They're looking for relaxation of government constraints so that we can really get these projects on the ground. So that's the reason for it.
So with that thought in mind, I'm going to share something with you. And that is, because a lot of these projects, when they're proposed, because they're really low, mm-hmm. and they're low-income projects, they're already seeking the state and using the state mandate as well. And within that, the state allows a reduction for parking and density for projects that meet the state requirements, which is our CAAB 2222. It's controlled by state legislation. So my question is if an applicant comes in and uses the state mandate and is already applying a reduction for parking, and we've already allowed a reduction for parking, they're kind of double dipping on the requirement for parking. And I wouldn't want to see that happen. I would like, if they come in with a state reduction and we've already allowed a reduction in parking,
I think there's a situation where the policy would allow the city to revise parking standards to require less parking for very low or low-income housing, period. And then on top of that, if the applicant comes in and wants a concession for increasing the density, says, city, I want to increase the density to provide affordable housing, they have the right to ask for that, and then we have to consider a certain number of concessions, one of which is parking. So in that respect, yes, yeah, they could achieve a kind of a double hit.
I guess what I would say is I'd revise
that situation
to say
here, but
parking would not be considered if they're already applying that incentive through the state standard. Mm-hmm. I would just, you know, I'm just thinking.
Other
could be used.
Other obstacles in the view of the state to providing affordable housing are strict requirements as regards height and setback and lot coverage. Parking's among those. So this particular policy speaks directly to parking, but mm-hmm. we probably could broaden it to mean development standards, and then we'd probably have a little more flexibility. That's something the commission might want to consider.
Okay.
Pretty much concludes my comments. One thing I am concerned about, you know, the housing element, you know, it's a wealth of information. I really invite the public to read that because there's a lot of statistical information there that was well put together and well thought out. And it really was an eye-opener to me what the median income is and, you know, what the affordability and how many people are actually in the city and what their income range is. And you're really finding that a lot of the low and very low income really isn't being satisfied. It makes up 40% of the need, and that's not what's being approved today in any of our projects. And I see all the, what's the term that's being used now of the housing, the alternative name for the housing, those products that are being provided right now are the $450,000 homes. But yet the people who, the mainstay of the income, can't afford it. And then you see a negative 21% of people between, what was it, 35, 45, where they're just leaving the area because they can't afford. We're not providing that opportunity for them. So I just wanted to make that statement. I'm done with my comments.
Thank you.
A couple things. First, it's nice to see this list of organizations that are being notified of what's happening. To me, one notable exception, and I know they know about it because they've heard about it elsewhere, is the school district. The school district, particularly with these emergency housing, you know, these emergency, you know, warming facilities and things of that nature, could end up being close to schools and have an impact on schools. But I think in general, looking at the housing element in total, the school district obviously is involved with educating over 10,000 students in the area. Obviously, a good number of those are not within the city limits of Aurora Grande, but a good number are from within the city limits of Aurora Grande. And they are maintaining some incredible statistics on age, demographics, you know, family income and things of that nature that would undoubtedly be very, very beneficial as these things are being reviewed, as well as they do have a specific interest in affordable housing as well, because they experience gains and losses in different age ranges because of affordability of housing. And so, you know, they're specifically impacted and a significant employer and in a significant, I don't want to call them a business, but certainly an organization here locally that has a real interest. I think that their names certainly ought to be added onto that list, and probably included in probably 98% of the stuff that goes out when we start talking about housing and things of this nature in the community. The only comment that I'll make is philosophically, I think that Mr. Mack and I probably agree more than we disagree. It's just very, very challenging when you start talking about housing and parking. There's obvious, you know, state goals and regional goals to encourage, you know, carpooling, discourage individual use of automobiles and things of that nature. With gasoline down in the low $2 range, the incentive for those of us, particularly in coastal California, is diminished. California is either well known or notorious for demanding high use of their personal automobiles, and it becomes very, very challenging to start dictating and achieving those goals or working towards those goals of greater density and forcing less parking, not allowing adequate parking, as faced with the reality of those that are buying and renting and moving in kind of demanding a parking space, and that poses a real big challenge. And piggybacking on that, I'd like to see the local flexibility continue in this area, and would not be in favor of trying to take away an opportunity of developers wanting to look for exceptions and things of that nature. In my mind, the ordinances should be written for the vast majority of projects that are coming across the desks of, you know, the city and looking at that type of development. When we get into large size developments, as well as some other very specific, you know, projects, I think that we exist as a commission and the city council exists as a body to be able to review and evaluate those on an individual basis. And I'm not a big fan of creating more restrictions or more, you know, ordinances that are limiting that. I'm in favor of let's continue to allow that flexibility, and if someone is able to double dip and can successfully address the needs of a specific population, let's evaluate that when it comes up. Those are my comments.
Thank you.
Well, I just had two comments mainly. I was just wondering, where is that IMU and HMU? I mean, I didn't see an exhibit. Do we actually have area that is available in those zoning designations for these shelters?
This slide shows essentially it's the IMU, and what this is showing is the 300-foot distance from a school. Yeah. So you can see here that basically here's the school property. So it's it takes away this area, so therefore for the IMU it mostly be concentrated on properties immediately adjacent to El Camino Real. And then for the HMU is in this darker purple area, and there is no, where am I?
Isn't that lavender area there along adjacent?
Oh, I'm sorry, the lavender, yeah.
Isn't that already occupied by industrial?
Well, there's going to be, Well, most of the city is you know, within the commercial areas is largely built out, but you never know if something vacates, then you'd have an opportunity to put something in there. The highway mixed-use development doesn't have any restrictions with regards to distance from any sensitive receptors such as a school or any nearby other facilities that serve the same purpose as an emergency shelter. So the highway mixed-use area, there was a comment from Planning Commission last time that the IMU was, you know, not close to services. HMU is closer to services and has less restriction with regards to what I just talked about with the 300-foot radius. However, yeah, it's basically subject to what's available at the time. Using existing buildings, you never know what's going to happen for a commercial establishment if they, decide to move elsewhere, and that proposes an opportunity for an emergency shelter to move in.
And these, we're not picking a location. We're just providing areas, that are generally underutilized land that might change over time, that have some area that are outside of the radius from a sensitive receptor. And these are two zoning districts that are, potentially available.
Well, then that leads me to the question is how if there isn't any available area in those two zoning designations at the current time, how do we provide that housing? How do we meet the requirements for providing that housing?
We don't have to. It's just like we don't have to provide the units for the housing element update. When we say we have to do that number of units, it's just that we have to show that we have the zoning and the land available. What the state is asking for is to provide the zoning available to allow this to occur. It's not saying, hey, where are you going to site this? No, it's not like that.
The other thing is, on the income category, where you got the number of units, the 242, how are we at the current time as far as meeting any of these requirements, the required number of units, the very low income at 60 and...
Well, we don't have to actually accommodate these units. We just have to show that we have the land available to do that. Yeah. And we do, and that's in the land inventory and the housing element. As far as progress made, we've had several affordable housing projects that have recently been approved and constructed. So we are making headway.
So we're meeting some of this quota.
So we completely do. Yeah, and all of that is reported in the housing element.
And then my concern too is, every project that's come through here has been an issue about parking. So.
Right.
And, we've already discussed that, so no sense in reviewing it again. But, it just seems like, we approve a project with insufficient parking, and then the next thing you know, we've got neighborhood residents complaining about it. So, and there's no other way of avoiding that without not approving it in the first place. That's it. Okay. It's your turn.
Okay, I don't have any questions right now, so I'll open the public hearing. Anybody in the audience that would like to address the commission on this subject? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and bring back the comments of the commission. Commissioner Back, you want to start out? Comments, or did you include your comments?
I've kind of included my comments, but I did have questions about the negative deck, and this lies the confusion, because to me it's like we're looking at it as if we're going to be adding those 242 units as opposed to just making space. And if we were really allocating 242 units, I would have a real hard time going through every one of these checklist items and putting no impact, no impact, no impact. And the two that come to mind that I would at least change to less than significant impact, at least acknowledge that we have an issue with traffic, because we do have some intersections that are not operating appropriately, and then water, because that is an issue. Because collectively, if we, you know, put X amount of trips for residential use, I mean, we could be adding, what, another, say, you know, 1,000, 1,200 trips to these already inundated intersections, because they're all going to shop where everyone else shops. They're all going to be going over here to Walmart and our two grocery stores that we have in town, so those intersections will get impacted to some degree in a collective situation. But if these projects come forward individually, then those impacts will be looked at individually on an individual basis and then mitigated individually. So that's why I would be inclined to at least acknowledge that those issues exist and do less than significant impact on the negative debt.
The document does specify in many places that each project that comes forward will be evaluated environmentally on its own merit.
And just think of it this way: the housing element is looking at the city's ability to accommodate housing especially in the realms that have been discussed. And so, for example. We found that we weren't providing the room for that via zoning, and we needed to upzone some areas of the city in order to do that. Well, then this neg deck would look entirely different. So, the purpose for this document is to acknowledge, you know, that we looked at all the categories and any impacts and. And it turns out that we didn't have to make any changes in order to implement this housing element with what's already accommodating via zoning and on our zoning map, for example. So that might help you think about how to view this document.
Thank you. But I'm all for the changes in terms of the emergency shelters and the locations. I think they're appropriate for the uses that are identified. The one that I may be having problems with is just the residential neighborhood characteristic and providing a shelter within a neighborhood setting. But other than that, the other residential uses are appropriate, I think, and the highway mixed use is appropriate. I'm curious to see how the rest of the commission feels about that.
Is there a transit service that goes down through El Camino where these areas are designated for transportation? Because now we've reduced, you know, all this parking situation and relying on, you know, public transportation. I didn't know if there were any stops along those areas to provide transportation for them.
I believe there are, but the bottom line, though, is if there was to be a facility, emergency shelter, sited on El Camino Real, we would work extremely closely with the county to ensure that there is adequate stops and frequency to assist with that particular facility. Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you. An observation about this double dipping that really concerns me. It seems like that if a developer wanted to have a viable project, why would he not want to have parking places for all the people that live there? And the only way you can justify that is if like Self Health is going to build it, they're going to have enough parking places because they're going to own and operate it. If a developer is coming in and build it to sell, he's going to try to get away with the least amount of parking spaces that is. That's just a fact of life. So I've never seen this double dipping in my tenure. So it really doesn't concern me a lot, but just
just to think that that could happen to us, I think is pretty interesting.
I wanted to mention that there is something in the code with regards to the density bonus provisions that, you know, if there's any environmental impact, and they have to show financial information as well, but I mean, we also, they're still subject to CEQA. So if we were to say that traffic and circulation was not, or parking was not going to be adequately provided, then, and we had a study that said that, then that might be the vehicle of getting there to address that particular issue. Teresa?
The policy D1 includes the language that Commissioner Mack mentioned, and that's the relaxation of parking standards. It's very specific to apartments that are for seniors or for low or very low income. So it has to be apartment project, restricted, and in that case, it would fall within generally a managed unit building like People Self-Help. So where they're going to, as they've historically have done in the city, provided and not asked for that deviation from the parking more than our code normally allows. So in that case, you're right, Commissioner Keene, you probably don't have to worry about the double hit, but that policy is there to incentivize as to the maximum extent trying to invite such units into the city.
Thank you. I'm ready to move forward with this, both these resolutions, so I would entertain a motion. I notice that on the resolution, one of them says 14002 instead of 14006 on the title.
Are we seeking two separate resolutions?
Yes.
That is correct.
I'll start on the first one then. I move to approve a resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Rio Grande recommending City Council approve General Plan Amendment Number 14-002, adopting the housing element update and the negative declaration.
Second? I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? We have a roll call, please. Debbie?
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
And Vice Chair Keene?
Yes. Okay, our roll. You want to do that one?
Hey, let's go. I move to approve a resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Rio Grande recommending the City Council adopt an ordinance approving Development Code Amendment Number 14-006 regarding emergency shelters and supportive and transitional housing citywide.
Second?
I'll second it.
Any discussion? Roll call, please.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Commissioner Fowler Payne?
Yes.
Commissioner Mack?
Yes.
Vice Chair Keene?
Yes. Okay, 9 and 9A, there's no non-public hearing items. Item 10, notice of administrative decisions. We have one. There's no further discussion. We'll move on. Any discussion?
None.
Commission communications. Anybody have any staff communications?
Yes, I have two community meetings to invite you to, and any members of the public to, and they're in the next 2 days. The first meeting is a community meeting for the Bridge Street Bridge Project. That's tomorrow morning here in Council Chambers at 8:30. And this meeting will provide an update of the project for the Bridge Street Bridge rehabilitation or replacement. Both alternatives have been churning through the environmental phase of the project, and both you know, significant issues have been resolved, and both continue to be very feasible alternatives. So tomorrow we'll receive a presentation by the consultants. They'll be here. They'll have a presentation for everybody to update everybody on the work that has been done and the status of the project. And we're going to be trying to invite some discussion on some of the attributes of the bridge and the types of railings and so forth that we want to be able to get some input on. So that is the first one. The second is a rainwater catchment workshop, and this is all about using rainwater as a water resource for this project. This community meeting is will be held on March 3rd at 6 p.m. again right here at Council Chambers. It's free, and it is being presented in conjunction with the Coastal Resource Conservation District. Kelly Heffernan has been the project manager in for the city, and there'll be lots of great information provided on how to install best management practices, catchment systems, really trying to catch that rainwater when it comes and get it into the ground or on your landscape. So I believe this will be very useful. We already have, I think, almost 50 people signed up. So it seems to be a popular workshop. We're one of three cities participating in this program, three communities, and we're very pleased about our ability to participate. So I invite you to the workshop and tell all your friends. And that's all for staff communications.
Thank you. Kelly, how many of those $1,000 rebates you got?
How many what now?
Of those $1,000 rebates you have to give out.
We've had quite a few in Arroyo Grande and in San Luis. The community of Napomo, they've been struggling a little bit, but yeah. And I will say that we have done it at our house in San Luis Obispo. We got the full $999. And we did rain barrels. We have seven rain barrels that look like really beautiful ceramic faces. And we have succulents that are planted on top. And we got those in July right before the big rains. And we were ready to irrigate all of our landscaping after that. It works. It works really well. So anyway.
Okay. I forgot one thing. I attended and went through the process of the grant, the city's grant program that the council has divided up now into two different projects. But anyway, the one that we as a body or as volunteers had $20,000 to give away to grant to people, to the 11 applicants. And it was a chore because almost every one of them is, you know, very, very deserving. A lot of good things they do in the community, and it's hard and heartbreaking to do at the same time. But we worked through it pretty quick, and it all turned out well, and we gave away the $20,000 after the council hears it. So next year, if somebody else would like to do that, it's a very fulfilling process. So next year you can get another volunteer. Thank you. Then may I move for adjournment? Adjourned.